This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in today for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Princeton African American Studies Professor Imani Perry, was born in Birmingham, Alabama. Though she moved away with her family as a child and has lived in Cambridge, Chicago, and the Philadelphia area, she's always considered Birmingham home. Perry has a new book about the American South, written as a journey through its states, cities, and rural communities. In each chapter, she focuses on a place and reflects on its distinctive relationship to the region's history of slavery and racism, drawing on her own extensive knowledge of literature, music, art, and folklore, as well as her own family history. Imani Perry earned a bachelor's degree from Yale, then a law degree at Harvard, where she also received her Ph.D. in American Studies. She's currently the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton and the author of six previous books, including Looking for Lorraine, a biography of playwright Lorraine Hansberry, and most recently, Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. Her new book is South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon Line to Understand the Soul of a Nation. Well, Imani Perry, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
You are, as I said, a child of the South, a native of Birmingham, but now teaching in an Ivy League institution. What made you want to take this journey into the South? Where did this come from?
It has a couple of different origin points. I mean, one, of course, is it's my home, but I have spent my life in some ways in exile, much of the time in exile of the South, and I have been traveling back and forth the majority of my life. And I've had this experience of being both an insider and also seeing how the South is seen. And from a young age, you know, experiencing some frustration about the misperception. But, you know, as an intellectual and a scholar over time, it just became increasingly clear to me that the misunderstanding of the South, the depiction of it as this sort of some other backwards different place in other regions, is actually part of the way in which we mischaracterize the nation. So that's sort of the heart of it. It both comes from frustration and also wanting to share and illuminate something.
The frustration that people see the South as some, how did you say, a distant backward place?
Yeah, distant, backward, that's where racism is, that's where, you know, social dysfunction is, that's where people are uneducated, and I mean, there's all these stereotypes of the South that I think are because the South in some ways becomes the repository for the nation's sins, right? Like, that's the bad place down there, and then it allows the rest of the country to conceive of itself as relatively pristine, when in reality, the South has so often not only not been backwards, but really the vanguard of the way the nation would develop, you know, from the very outset, right? It's where it begins. A huge proportion of the founding fathers are Southerners. It's where D.C. is located because the South paid Revolutionary War debts, and then it's where the prosperity of the nation developed through King Cotton, and it's oil, it's coal. There are so many of the things that sort of made the nation possible that come out of the South, and the conditions that made it possible are the very things that are part of the painful history of the South that, you know, we try to sort of excise from the mythology of the nation, but are really key to understanding it.
Your chapter about Birmingham is personal in a lot of ways. I mean, it's your own home. And it's interesting that you write that, you know, people talk about the Great Migration as being a movement of African-Americans from the South to the North, but you write in many cases, including, I guess, your grandparents, it was from the rural South to the urban South. They went to Birmingham. And you talk about the story of your birth, about your mom had a relationship with a man that didn't last, the result of which was your birth. And then she met the man you would know as your father. You want to just tell us the story here?
Yeah. So, you know, my dad, who raised me and passed away about just under 6 years ago, was a Jewish man from Brooklyn who was inspired by the civil rights movement and so chose to work, finished a PhD at Yale and chose to go down south and work at a historically black college and met my mother at the orientation of the, you know, for new faculty. And so, and my mother, you know, was also a political organizer. So they had this unusual union, you know, in what was once known as the most segregated city in the country, and tried to, you know, have a revolution, as it were. And I grew up in at that crossroads, you know, of a multiracial kind of activist, radical in many ways, politically leftist community, and also very much in a kind of traditional black working class Southern family. And so a part of what I wanted to show, you know, the world kind of freezes Birmingham in 1963, and it was just this really fascinating, blooming, growing place through the 70s and 80s. So I use my personal story to talk about that complexity.
And then you go off to, you know, get an education up north. Did you go to Concord Academy? Do I remember that correctly?
I did.
Very
yes.
Prestigious private school, and then Yale, and then Harvard for a law degree and all of that. And you're in a world of people who, as you say, probably have a lot of preconceptions about the South. Did you find yourself bristling constantly when you heard their prejudices expressed?
Oh, all the time. Oh, yes. I mean, even younger, you know, and people, and I will say this, like across, I mean, all kinds of identities. I mean, even, it was just a couple of weeks ago, someone said, oh, I'm too afraid to go down South. Right? It's another black woman. And, you know, that fear and also this idea, this myth that there's not an urban South. So people, unless it's Atlanta or New Orleans, people think, you know, you're in some rural community. So people would say things to me like, oh, you know, must be weird to be around cows and chickens. And at a certain level, I was around chickens, like people next door did have chickens in the backyard, but it was still a city. I would bristle and also, you know, be frustrated by the sort of mocking characterizations of the South.
I will say, I mean, I identify with this. I grew up in Texas. My grandparents my granddaddy actually drove cattle up near Lubbock, but I've spent most of my life up north. And yeah, people think they know, and they make, sometimes I will say, yeah, we actually got indoor plumbing now, believe it or not.
Right. Can you imagine? Right.
But the other interesting observation I had about it, I thought, was, you know, when I grew up in South Texas, Corpus Christi, and in a not particularly enlightened time, I was born in the 50s and came up north in the 70s. And it seemed to me that when I got here, I went in Philadelphia and had a lot of working class jobs when I was in my 20s. And it just seemed I heard the N-word a lot more.
All the time.
In working class communities of the north than I had in Corpus Christi, Texas, which admittedly did not have a large black population. It was it's interesting that people assume racism has its heart and its home in places that not where they live, but they're not quite looking at it so clearly.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that, and people are astonished when I tell them this, but, you know, when my fear about race as a kid was ignited in Boston. You know, that's the place where I experienced racial terror, with bottles thrown at our car and having slurs hurled at me. I have never in any place in the South had someone call me a racial slur. I've had it happen numerous times in Massachusetts, you know, more than I can count. Now, it's not, and so my point is not, though, that, you know, up north is more racist than the South or something, but that disposition to sort of imply that that's a Southern thing actually gives a lot of freedom to not confront the racism in other parts of the region. But also, part of the reason I haven't heard slurs in the South is, you know, something will happen if that moment occurs, right? So, like, if someone hurls a slur at me in Birmingham, there's almost certainly going to be violence to follow, right? You know, there was a civil rights revolution. There were a lot of people who gave their lives for it. That was a hard-fought battle. Those moments are not going to be casually passed by anymore, right? So there's a detente right? There's a sort of, there are these sort of silent spaces that exist so that people can negotiate around each other and around history. Some of that doesn't exist in quite the same way in northern cities, but the attitudes, you know, the idea that people are inferior on the basis of being Black or of not being white, right, or not being fully American, as, you know, Mitch McConnell recently implied, that does come from Southern history, but it is American history too, right? It is that attitude, that belief system about human beings is what allowed for the exploitation of Black labor, the moving out of indigenous people, you know, all of those sorts of things. So it's not as though like the South is better, it's or more racist, but it is the in some ways an origin point for the way the whole nation operates. Like the ideas about race, we get them from the way the stage was set in the South from the beginning.
I wanted to talk about the book that you wrote before this, I guess, just a couple of years ago, called Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. Tell me where the idea for this book came from.
So the idea for the book came from my editor at Beacon Press. And, you know, she was sort of responding to how on social media I will talk about my sons. And usually it's sort of, you know, the sort of funny stories about coming of age and the like. And she said, would you like to write something about parenting, and in particular in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement, right, and parenting Black boys in that context? And I said, well, yeah. And as I started to write it, kind of developed into something, I think, more than what initially was intended. I wanted to communicate a tradition, you know, in which I wanted to raise my children in, of seeing themselves and their possibilities as greater than what the society anticipated for them or how they were seen, right? So I was drawing on previous work in particular, you know, and obviously there's both Coates Between the World and Me and Baldwin's The Fire Next Time and The Letter to His Nephew. But I also wanted to think very specifically about gender in that too, and what it meant to sort of try to talk about all of these issues from the perspective of a woman, and particularly of a feminist, right? Someone who wanted to also raise sons who were free from all of the burdens and the attitudes associated with patriarchy, wanting to raise sons who could be fully expressive of the complexity of who they are and to really feel free, even while knowing that things are not completely free in this world.
You say early in the book that a statement that goes around a lot is, it must be terrifying to raise a Black boy in America. Your reaction to this statement?
It would make me so angry. I felt oftentimes, and I say in the book, I know that people didn't have bad intentions, but it felt so voyeuristic, and it also felt like it diminished the incredible beauty of raising children, you know, to that. And I, you know, they were funny and smart and imaginative and curious, and every day is this kind of beautiful adventure. And I felt so often that my parenting was being diminished to racism. And I also felt that it was really important that I not raise them to move with fear as a dominant emotion, because I didn't want to clip their wings. I wanted them to fly. I'd want them to fly, to feel a sense of expansiveness and possibility. So to me, there's a resistance that is important in not limiting my imagination about what it means to raise them to the fact that this is a racist society.
Yeah, you're telling me it is not a terror, it's a gift.
It's a gift, yeah.
Yeah. You say to your sons in the book, you are second generation integrators, meaning, I guess, that you've had to learn to navigate living at times in a largely white world as they do now? Is that what you meant?
Yes. And also that, you know, they, like me, you know, they attended predominantly white private schools, elite schools. And what's so interesting about that is that even several generations in, for Black people, we continue to be conceived of as outsiders of a certain sort, as though these institutions don't belong to us. And so it's a sort of strange dynamic. It's related to Du Bois's concept of double consciousness, right? Whenever feels one's two-ness. It's analogous to what it means to be Black and American, right? That you very much belong. You know, you've always been here, and yet there's this sort of skepticism about you as part of an institution, and to understand that that's, you know, there's a source of grief there, but it's also a really important source of critical insight, and to understand how to harness the critical insight so as not to be overwhelmed by the grief. That's part of the challenge. So yeah, they are where I have been in so many ways.
Imani Perry, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in today for Terry Gross. If you know the name Buster Keaton, you probably think of him as a guy in old black and white silent movies known for slapstick and sight gags. It's true he had a gift for physical comedy, but that doesn't begin to describe his talent or his influence. In the 1920s, Keaton starred in and directed a string of silent films that are cited by a long list of great American filmmakers as inspirations. Orson Welles, to name one, called Keaton a supreme artist and said his film The General is one of the greatest of all time. Seven of Keaton's silent films are on the National Film Registry. Apart from his influence on American cinema, Keaton's story is a fascinating one. Born in the 19th century and a vaudeville star by the age of five, his life took some hard turns after his burst of creativity in the 20s. He fell from stardom and battled alcoholism, then regained his footing and had a long career in show business as a writer and performer. Our guest, Dana Stevens, is a veteran film critic who's written a new book about Keaton. Stevens is the film critic for Slate and co-host of its long-running podcast called Culture Gabfest. She's also written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and other publications. Her new book is Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema, and the Invention of the 20th Century. Well, Dana Stevens, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk.
I have become a Buster Keaton fan in part because the director of our program, Roberta Shorrock, has been sending me videos of his stuff for years, and they make me laugh out loud. But I'm guessing a lot of our audience has never seen a silent film beginning to end, kind of don't know this world. Let me just begin by asking you why you think he's an important figure in the story of American cinema.
I mean, not just in American cinema, but as this book is sort of trying to pull out the camera in order to talk about of American history, I would say, you know, I mean, his films, first of all, as you've said very well in your introduction, have just become these monuments of world cinema. And often now, you know, when there's these crowdsourced lists of the greatest films of all time, where critics from around the world contribute their titles, he will be the only silent filmmaker. Not always. Sometimes it's Chaplin pulling just ahead of him, but one of the two of them will often be the only silent filmmaker that makes it into that top 10 or top 25 or whatever it is, right? So silent cinema it still plays a very small role kind of on the periphery of the imagination, even of big cinephiles, you know, and film critics, I think. And it's understandable why. I mean, so many of those movies are lost forever. You know, something like 75 to 80% of silent films that were ever made are now gone because they were not valued by the generations that came right after and, you know, were just essentially discarded after they made the rounds and were shown. And silent film really fell into a period of decades where it was just simply not a concern, not coming to anyone's attention and not being preserved or promulgated in any way. And that's been changing slowly, you know, in the decades, basically since Keaton's death in the 60s, 70s, 80s onward. But I feel like his legacy is something that's really just a beautiful and important part of American history, you know, not just American film history, but American history and the history of American art.
Right. He kind of came into the 20th century as so much was changing. He was born in Kansas, 1895, and at a young age got involved in his family's vaudeville act. And I thought we'd listen to an excerpt of Buster himself talking about this. This is later in life, and you'll hear music underneath his voice. This is part of a documentary called A Hard Act to Follow. Buster Keaton here talking about his parents and their vaudeville act.
By the time I was 4 years old, I was a regular member of the act, wearing flap shoes and grotesque clothes with a bald-headed wig and Irish beard on. My dad was a comedian and a great eccentric dancer and tricks. He wasn't exactly an acrobat, but darn near. And my mother played musical instruments and danced with him. And of course, when I came into the act, then he got the idea of trying to show the audience how to bring up children correctly. And every time I did something he didn't like, he'd take me with the back of the neck and throw me through a piece of scenery. I grew up getting knocked around.
So, kind of a rough and tumble act. Tell us about it. What do we know about this act that he did with his parents?
I mean, this was a really fascinating part of the book to research because, of course, there's no record of this act. Film existed at the time that they were doing the Three Keatons slapstick act, but the act was never filmed, just like most vaudeville acts of the time were never recorded on film. And so it's only through, you know, Buster's way of telling stories about it and contemporary reviews of people who saw it at the time and really just the lore that was passed down about it that anybody knows what that act was. But as you sort of hear in his very laconic explanation of it there, what the act essentially was this act of about a child sassing his father. It was about the father-son relationship. And Joe Keaton, Buster's dad, you know, would play the role of this loving father who was going to teach the audience about parenting. But it was all kind of an ironic joke because behind him, you would see Buster doing some kind of mischief on the stage where he was preparing to, you know, attack his father in some way. And then this would all resolve in, you know, his father learning about the deception and hurling Buster into the backdrop, into the wings, into the audience or the orchestra pit occasionally. It really was known as one of the most violent acts in vaudeville. And, you know, that was what people loved about it. That was along with the great acrobat, the tricks that Buster could do. You know, there was just the danger that something might happen to this small child who seemed to be indestructible. And so one of the things I wanted to trace was how, you know, you really see that exact same dynamic happening in every Buster Keaton movie. It's almost as if the sensation that he wants to evoke in his audience is, how could he do that and live, you know, but be laughing at the same time as they're gasping over the danger.
Explain the suitcase handle sewn into Buster's coat. That's a lovely little detail.
Yes, that's
this.
Nice. That was something when he was smaller. The basketball actually was something that evolved later in their act when Buster was too big to throw, you know, and the teenage Buster had to figure out some way to torment his father. And that act with the basketball also gets brought up in some movies later. But yes, when he was a very small child, his mother sewed a suitcase handle into the back of his costume, his little performing jacket, so that his father could more easily grasp him and hurl him into whatever, you know, solid object he felt like throwing him at.
Right. Did critics take notice of the kid, the young Keaton, as the act developed?
Absolutely. And that was something that was really fascinating to trace in researching his childhood, is just that the way he was talked about from when he was very, very young, since he entered his parents' act when he had just turned 5 years old for the first time, you know, professionally, the amount of coverage and the tone of the coverage changed very, very quickly. You know, you can really trace this meteoric rise through just reading how he was written about. So, you know, if you read about him a month after he starts performing with the act, it's something like, little Buster Keaton is assisting his parents in their comedy special or something like that. And 6 months later, you know, there'll be some piece of vaudeville press that says, Buster Keaton, the star of the Keaton combination of three, you know, so it becomes obvious that he's really leading the show, including creatively. I mean, from a pretty young age, maybe not five, but from when he certainly was 8 or 9 or so, I think a lot of the jokes in this continually evolving slapstick act he had with his father came from his own invention, you know. And so I think a big part was that, unlike a lot of vaudeville acts who would work up a shtick and then just do it that entire season on the road, I think the Keatons, you could always see something new every time you saw them, which was another big part of what kept them so popular.
The other fascinating thing about that is a kid can be thrown, but, you know, if he gets hurt and can't perform, then it kind of ruins the act. He had to learn how to take falls and do it safely. I mean, this is something that, you know, modern stunt performers, you know, learn a craft in order to execute. I mean, you say, we don't have film, we don't know. But somehow he managed to learn to do that. And it's clearly an amazing skill that he carried into his adult film career, right?
Right. I mean, it would be really hard to find someone now, you know, in a biopic of Buster Keaton, say, to play the child Keaton or the young adult Keaton, because nobody could do those tricks anymore, you know. And I think that was not just because of his own kind of prodigious talent as an individual, but the milieu that he grew up in, you know, and his ability to channel all of the performance forms that he saw around him. So he was growing up in this vaudeville circuit, constantly traveling, you know, didn't really have a set home to live in until he was in his 20s. And all the time picking up juggling and wire walking and, I don't know, sharpshooting and whatever skills came along on the road. So really within his body were encoded all of these traditions that he could perform exceptionally well in. And so that's in that way, I think when he died, all of that died with him, you know, and when those generations of vaudevillians with those skills that came from the history of entertainment died out, that particular performance style is kind of inaccessible to us now.
So Buster Keaton did this act with his mom and dad into his teens, and the act eventually broke up, and that's part of what spurred him to get into his own performing. What happened?
The act breaking up is a big, really sort of the first big dramatic beat in Buster's story in his life. I mean, he had a pretty uninterrupted upward trajectory as a child, right? With a couple of little hiccups, like the time they got thrown out, prohibited from performing in New York State for a couple years. But essentially, from the moment he stepped on stage, he was on this, you know, steady ascent. And the first real hiccup came along in his teens when his father, who was starting to drink way too much, who got violent when he drank, who was expressing anger on stage at Buster for things that had happened off stage, as Buster himself said in interviews. And the act really just became something that was untenable. Joe was also getting on the wrong side of all kinds of vaudeville theater managers and just kind of ruining the act's reputation. And so there was this moment that they got demoted, essentially, to traveling a 3-show-a-day vaudeville circuit, not one of the top circuits that allowed you to perform just twice a day, but a 3-show-a-day circuit that paid less, you traveled more. Essentially, they had harder lives all of a sudden. And Buster's mother, as he tells it in an anecdote he told his first biographer, his mother said, "I can't take it anymore. We've got to leave your father." And so very dramatically, in the midst of a tour, they just hopped a train, left Joe at a Los Angeles theater with his trunk, and they were gone. He did eventually sort of rejoin the family, although he never lived with his wife again. He wasn't estranged from them forever, but that was a very decisive moment where, you know, this family that had spent basically every moment together, you know, for Buster's entire life, living on trains, performing, traveling around, were suddenly split up, and he needed to reimagine himself as a solo performer and decide what he was going to do next, which at first was not the movies.
Let's talk about some of the films that Buster directed in the 1920s and starred in. Now, he was not just the star of this, right? I mean, he was a director, and that kind of maybe meant a bit of a different thing in that era. In what sense did he really make these films? What kind of a role did he play?
I mean, he played almost every role. That's maybe a little unfair to his many wonderful collaborators. He also had a team of craftspeople, you know, production designers and gag writers who he worked with for many years and who also contributed a lot to these movies that they were creating. But ultimately, yes, it was completely his vision. And he was not only the star and essentially director, even though he is often not credited on screen as the director of all of these silent movies that he made, but, you know, the stuntman did every stunt. I mean, this is not, you know, the modern Hollywood star always saying, "I do my stunts." This is actually somebody making sure to place the camera at a far enough away angle that you can really verify that it's his body there doing all of those dangerous things at once. He was also his film's editor. You know, so at this very early stage, when film was just sort of defining what it was, all of those divisions of labor had not calcified in the way that they do now, you know, and it, I think, to him made complete sense that he would be in the cutting room, you know, putting his film together himself instead of farming it out to an editor. So when you see a silent Buster Keaton film, you know, one of the ones made between 1920 and 1928 or so, you really are seeing something that came entirely out of his brain, no matter who's being credited as director on screen.
You know, he was an innovator in filmmaking, and there are a couple of films that reflect this. One of them is a film called Sherlock Jr., and in particular, a scene where he plays a guy who's a projectionist in the theater who falls asleep and then dreams of entering the movie. Tell us what he does here.
Oh, yeah, this is wonderful. I mean, this is a great starter, Buster Keaton, if you've never seen any of his movies, because it really, it's nice and short. It's about an hour long, and it really shows all the things that he could do, both with his body and with the camera. So, yeah, the conceit that he had, which actually his longtime cinematographer was the one who dreamed up, is why don't you play a projectionist who falls asleep and dreams his way into a movie? And it was because of the technical challenge of wanting to make that happen, you know, to see someone climb into a movie and become a part of it, that he was fascinated enough to do the film. And he loved to talk about the technique of how they actually did this. What they did was they created a stage set and lit it. His wonderful cinematographer, Elgin Leslie, who we worked with for many years, lit this stage set in a sort of flat way so that it would look like the screen of a movie to trick the eye of the viewer. And then we just see him, you know, sort of climbing in from the stage. But at that moment, of course, the Keaton character finds himself inside a movie and not sort of able to adjust to the world of being in a movie. And there's just an incredible editing gag where the Buster Keaton on the screen finds himself in a space. The movie within a movie then cuts to a completely different space, like at one point a lion's cage with a lion in it, and suddenly he's in that space, right? So he's sort of trapped in this loop of editing, and that's like a wonderful joke in the middle of the movie.
It's an amazing effect for a movie made in the 1920s. It looks like the guy actually walks into the movie and enters it, which today people would figure, ah, you can do that. But it's remarkable that he did it in those early years.
Yeah, he loved to brag about the fact that always tricked people. Later in life, in interviews, he would say, I've seen that with many an audience, and nobody can ever figure out how it was done. And he said that all the other cinematographers at the time would go to see Sherlock Jr. to try to figure out how the climbing into the screen thing had been done.
It's interesting. He was not a man of a lot of pretense, was he? I mean, he didn't think of himself as a, you know, when people would call him a genius and an artist, he didn't like that, did he?
No, it's something fascinating to read when you read interviews with him, is that he loved to talk about technique, like I say, how he accomplished certain effects and things like that. He liked to tell stories about his childhood. He was not resistant to speaking to interviewers, but he was not introspective or self-analytical at all. And he, in fact, was resistant to the idea, you know, that his work meant anything other than trying to make people laugh. And if he was called a genius or an artist or anything like that, I think tended to really withdraw and start to mistrust the person who had said that to him.
What would he say? Yeah, you can't be a genius in slap shoes and a pork pie hat or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
The silent era came to an end with the 20s, essentially, as a lot of things in the United States were changing, including the film industry. And that was when Buster Keaton lost his independence and signed a contract with the studio MGM, where, you know, it was a big corporate machine and he had roles and it was all written and the production schedules were defined and he kind of had to do what he was told. This didn't suit him well, did it?
No. I mean, this is a very painful part of the book to research, and the movies that he made at that point are painful to watch, and even more painful in a way is that they were successful. And, you know, every talkie that he made at MGM that he regarded as the worst turkeys he'd ever turned out, and that nobody watches now, really, unless you're researching the dark years of Buster Keaton, were all moneymakers for him. You know, and part of that was that MGM had a strong marketing arm, and he had a big name, and people just went to see the new Buster Keaton movie because it was there. But tastes were also changing in the early days of sound. And, you know, sound comedies, very few of early sound comedies make us laugh now. But the things that made people laugh when sound was new often had to do with just the novelty of hearing people speaking and hearing music and having sound incorporated into the film-going experience in the first place.
You write that to see him in talkies is to witness the extinguishing of a singular artist's creative spark and the erosion of his professional confidence. Why were these movies so bad? I mean, people went to see them. And can you think of an example?
I mean, it's possible that the film I was talking about then was What No Beer, which is maybe his very most painful film to watch at MGM because it was toward the end. It was, in fact, the last film he made with them as their star comedian. And by that time, he really was deep into depression, alcoholism. You know, he just had a very painful divorce. He was just in an absolutely chaotic and miserable time of his life. And it 100% shows up on screen. And it's just awful to see him, you know, seeming so miserable, especially because this character that he had always played, which, as you said, was a resourceful, plucky, you know, someone who was put upon by the world and always getting out of disastrous situations, but who had a lot of resources to do so, kind of inner resources.
Spunk and gumption, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right. And during this period at MGM, somehow his, you know, his passivity, the passivity of his character, that kind of essential quiet that he always had in his silent films, gets misinterpreted as, masochism almost. And those MGM movies really involve a lot of some things that hark back to the Joe Keaton, Buster Keaton act in that they're violent, but not in that they're funny. You know, so there's a lot of scenes of him kind of being manhandled by bigger characters, being thrown around, having no power. He doesn't get the girl anymore. anymore. He's kind of the outcast almost, or, you know, he's sort of the loser in some of these movies. And it doesn't suit his character at all. It doesn't suit his sense of humor. And I feel like at MGM, they just never really figured out who he was. You know, they couldn't figure out what kind of vehicles to buy for him, what kind of material to put him in. And, or the simple fact that, you know, there are some performers that if you give them their freedom, they'll do all sorts of incredible things. And if you take away their freedom, they're an animal in a cage. And that, I think, is how he felt and how he seemed in his films while he was at MGM. So his drinking, which had already been, you know, something that ran in the family, his father was an alcoholic, his mother seems to have drunk almost every day, like sat and played cards and drank bourbon every day. And he came from that culture, but it really intensified after his marriage started to fall apart, after his job satisfaction went down to zero, and, you know, during those miserable years. As a result, he was fired from MGM by Louis B. Mayer in 1933 and had a couple of years really on the skids where he had a lot of trouble finding work. He did not have his drinking under control. At one point, he married his sobriety nurse, the woman who had been hired to look after him and make sure he didn't get drunk. And they spent a couple of seemingly miserable years together. And that was a very dark time in his life. Although I do try to make the point in my book that that was not the end for Buster, and to kind of shake your head and say it's too bad that he went off the rails and then just write him off is a complete underestimation of the drive that he had to entertain and to continue to work, and the need to work, because he had to support his entire family of origin, you know, as he did his whole life.
So he, you know, he had, after his divorce from his first wife, he had a 2-year marriage to Mae Scriven, who was this nurse helping with his sobriety. And then in 1940, I believe, he married Eleanor Norris, who was a contract dancer at MGM. This was a more mature relationship, made him happier, and he found a place in the business, didn't he? What did he do?
Yeah, I mean, this is what I mean about Keaton really managing to turn his life around in a way that I think often doesn't get appreciated in storytelling about his life. So over the course of the 1940s, he was behind the scenes at MGM as a gag writer and had success there, but, you know, wasn't really visible to audiences. But toward the end of the 40s and the early 50s, he started to get bit parts in big movies. He's in Sunset Boulevard, right? He has a little bit part in that. He's in a musical with Judy Garland where he has a small part. But not so much movies as TV really interested him. And, you know, just as always, He was always wanting to do the latest thing, right? He was in vaudeville at the height of vaudeville. He was in silent film at the height of the silent film era. And he really broke into television very early and found a lot of success there in all different kinds of roles. I mean, everything from, you know, having his own sort of sitcom at one point, appearing on The Donna Reed Show and lots of other sitcoms, The Twilight Zone, Candid Camera. I mean, there's just very little early TV that Keaton did not get in on in one way or another.
You mentioned viewing his stuff on YouTube. It's remarkable, as I was preparing for our conversation, how many of his films are on YouTube for free in this beautifully restored print, these beautifully restored prints. What would you recommend to somebody who wants to, a beginner who wants to develop an appreciation for Buster Keaton?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, it is important to know that almost all these movies are streaming, and most of them are streaming for free because they're in the public domain. So, you know, definitely just explore on your own. But I would say, for the short 20-minute films, watch 1 Week, which I think is one of his all-time masterpieces and one of the great American comedies. It's sort of a romantic comedy, let's put it that way, but with lots of slapstick, from 1920. Cops is another short that you just can't go wrong with. It's incredibly crowd-pleasing and full of just astonishing physical stunts. And then getting into the features, I mean, it really depends on your taste. But I would say that probably my two favorite Buster Keaton movies, maybe not the most famous, maybe not his favorites of his own, would be Sherlock Jr., which is from 1924. And the key image from this one, if you've seen it maybe in clip reels, is of him climbing into a movie screen and joining what's happening on screen, you know, essentially inserting himself into a movie in progress. And Steamboat Bill Jr., which was his last independent movie, and it's just a really beautifully accomplished movie, and a sad one to watch in that you realize that he was just hitting his stride, the height of his powers, and that was when his independence was just about to be taken away.
He died in 1966 of lung cancer. Was he a happy man then?
You know, I think he was. Actually, the last chapter of my book opens with this speculation, is sort of how much professional disappointment did Keaton feel at the end of his life? We know he was personally happy. That seems really, really evident from, you know, just all of the stories of his relationship with Eleanor and what she said about him after he died when she became a big guardian of his legacy. And Personally, I think there's no question that he found contentment, which is wonderful in itself. Professionally, it's another of those black boxes because he never stopped getting work, you know, after he got back to work after that dark time we talked about. He never stopped wanting to work or being curious about trying new things, but he also never got to direct a movie again. You know, he never got to be the lead of a movie again. He never got to devise comedy of the kind that only he could devise. And, there must have been somewhere deep buried inside some regret about, you know, having had such a wonderful flight of creativity for so many years and then, you know, having to work in a more constrained way. But when asked about it, he always said, I couldn't have had a luckier or happier life. You know, he was not a complainer. And I think he was pretty satisfied with the 3 score and 10 that he got on Earth.
Well, Dana Stevens, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It was an absolute delight. Thank you, Dave.
Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate. Her new book is Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema, and the Invention of the 20th Century. Neil Young's new album is called Barn, and that's where it was recorded, in an old barn on Young's property in the Colorado Rockies. It was cut in about 10 days with Young's longtime band Crazy Horse, musicians Young has performed with off and on for more than half a century. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Barn is the best Neil Young album in quite a while.
There's a sound you're likely to be familiar with. Neil Young's expressive yowling, backed by the ramshackle rhythms of Crazy Horse, pounding out new material on Barn. If you haven't listened to a Neil Young and Crazy Horse album in a long time, or maybe even thought about Neil Young in a long time, I ask you, has he ever written a prettier song than this one, called Tumbling Through the Years?
Well, I was walking down the road, one step. The love we share, you and me. It's a complicated thing, this life. If I wasn't here with you, tumbling through the years without our love.
You may say, hasn't Neil Young made some of his loudest, most raw music with Crazy Horse? You're probably thinking of great, big, and yes, loud albums like Zuma and Rust Never Sleeps. That aspect of Young's music, wielding his guitar like a sword slashing across his melodies, is very much a part of this album as well. Young's wife, the actor Daryl Hannah, filmed the making of the album in a drafty old barn, shaping a fine documentary that's available on the deluxe version of the album or as a separate release. Since this collection was recorded live, first or second takes only and just a few overdubs, you're essentially seeing Barn being built right in front of your eyes and ears. In Hannah's intimate images, Young and the 3 members of the current version of Crazy Horse, drummer Ralph Molina, bassist Billy Talbot, and guitarist Nils Lofgren, look like grizzled old prospectors still sifting for gold in the countryside. They find it, the music version anyway, more than once. That's the beginning of Welcome Back, an 8-minute mood piece that only seems to ramble. It gathers strength and purpose to become one of Young's very best We're All in This Mess Together songs. For a long time, Young has also been a nature writer, a composer of pastorals, fretting over the environment. This album finds him sometimes composing lyric hymns to the earth and sky, or raging against destruction on the horizon.
Today no one cares. Tomorrow no one shares. Because they all will be gone, but the children.
Children of the fires and floods.
Children of the fires and floods.
Neil Young's voice now sounds almost exactly the same as it did when he was a skinny Canadian telling us everybody knows this is nowhere. A half century later, he's cutting songs in a barn made from logs, the wind whistling through their cracks. The music here waves to us, a fond hello that's more full of spirit and life than we might have expected.
Ken Tucker reviewed Neil Young's latest album, Barn. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
When you're angry,